Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Hi. No, let's take that from the top. Oh, Lord.
Mm-hmm. Hi! How are you doing?
Sounds like, ooh, that does not come out of me normally. From Luminary, this is Here to Slay, the Black feminist voting rights podcast of your dreams. I am Tressie McMillan Cottom, y'all.
And I am your Negro suffragette, Roxanne Gay. On Here to Slay, Tressie and I talk not only about voting rights, we also get into books, movies, TV, theater, food, home decor, which, by the way, I'm enjoying all the pictures you're posting on Instagram about little tableaus. And
I love a tableau, girl.
How could you not? We also do talk about politics.
Yep. Try as we might, we cannot get away from politics, Roxanne. You know what? That is quintessential Black woman.
Yes.
We can never get away from politics. Mm-hmm. We win an election and get ready for a little R&R, but then what? The Democrats forget that they love, trust Black women. And then Republicans look for new ways to keep Black people from the polls and out of the body politic. And then we're right back where we started. We got to talk about
it. We do. On Here to Slay, we talk about it with women, mostly Black women, usually. Mm-hmm. Women in media, arts, politics, journalism, women like Tressie and I who have thoughts and opinions and who are getting shit done. Hey, girl. Hey.
Hey. Opinions, capital O.
Mm-hmm.
We're not lowercase O, no. Like some of those people.
Much to the chagrin of a lot of people that know us.
Isn't that the truth?
It is.
All right. So we are like amped up. I don't know about you, Roxanne. You're in California. Yes, I do know about you. I don't need to ask about how y'all's weather and environment
is
going.
Fabulous. It's fabulous. Like, 75.
It's gorgeous here in North Carolina. It's in the 70s. It is what my grandmother would have called pneumonia weather, but I don't care because I believe in science now, Grandma. And so I'm worried about all kinds of things, but I'm also thrilled. We can throw open the windows. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to live, even if it's just quarantine life, but this thing keeps pulling us back in. I feel like we have to pay a little bit of attention to what is happening on the national stage.
We do. And I got to tell you, Tressie, the weather is getting much better, and I'm excited about it. I'm thrilled, but I'm also terrified because I feel myself getting spring fever. Like,
oh,
I'm
girl.
Ready to live. And COVID is not over yet. We are not vaccinated yet. And
exactly.
So, you know, we're all going to have to just maintain a little more discipline to get through this.
I don't know if I'm going to make it, girl.
I don't either. Listen, I'm about ready to throw, I don't wear bathing suits, but I'm about to put a bikini on. And go do something somewhere. Like, you know what? Roaring 20s indeed.
All I want is a little air in my hair, a little sprinkling of the ocean on my face. Is this too much to ask
for,
Roxanne?
It is not. Go to that North Carolina shore. Feel the Outer Banks on you.
Mm. It misses me so much. But yeah, the politicians won't let us live.
They won't
let us be great. You're right. We are doing better with vaccinations, but are not where we need to be for us to just be all outside willy-nilly. And Biden is still in his first 100 days and has been busy, but maybe not busy in the ways we wish.
You know, we have to, I suppose, give any new politician, new president, some runway to get some things done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to really assess what a politician is doing until the first 100 days have passed. And we know that Biden inherited a real shit show.
To be fair. To be very fair.
You know, again, Democrats don't know how to hold power. You know, we have the House, we have the Senate, and yet it doesn't seem like it. It seems like Mitch McConnell is still in charge. And Joe Biden is already falling back on campaign promises. You know, last week we talked about he wants this $10,000 ceiling on the student loans. And I read a news article about how the first migrant detention camp for children opened under the Biden administration. And this was something he said that he was going to eradicate. And I suppose a lot of us are just cynical at this point because I read the story and I am horrified. But I, at the same time, I'm not particularly surprised.
One of the things that Democrats will tell you is, yes, we have a public mandate, but the mandate is weak, right? We took the House and the Senate, but the Democrats did lose seats in the House. They didn't do so great in state races, like across the board. Certainly not at the level we probably would have expected, considering how polarized the electorate was at the time. So Democrats defend themselves here by saying, well, we've got a mandate, but we don't have a filibuster-proof mandate. And because of that, we've got to, you know, negotiate. We want to bring people to the table. But what that looks like, bringing people to the table, is it does look like continuing things like migrant children's detention camps, which is basically what they are. It looks like basically giving away parts of the store before the Republicans even demand it of us. So I don't, I don't know if it's that I'm cynical. I think I'm pragmatic when I say I'm not sure we're going to get the big, bold, sweeping political gestures from this administration that we were hoping to get.
Correct. And it's a kind of a bitter pill to swallow because, you know, we keep hearing these Democrats talk about how we need Republicans. And I'm like, who is we? And Republicans don't give a fuck whether or not there are any Democrats around. They are merciless in terms of enacting their agendas. And I'm not saying that we should lower ourselves to their level. But at the same time, we should absolutely lower ourselves to their level and get some things done and lead like we want to be leaders. And part of that is to combat voter suppression because the shenanigans have already started in Georgia.
Yeah. Listen, they never stopped, but then they ramped up after they lost that runoff election, honey.
That no voting on Sundays, that no early voting on Sundays. I'm like, so that that's a direct note to say we don't want any Black people to vote.
That's right. Georgia, of course, is the center of the South where Black voter turnout relies significantly on Black church turnout. And so what will often happen in the South, for those of you who are not familiar, you go to church on Sunday if you're Black, go to your good AME Zion, you have your service, your preacher stands up and says, there are going to be buses out front after service for the elderly and shut in. But listen, everybody gets on that bus. And you go down to the polls. That's how you, they deliver and turn out the Black vote in a lot of these Black Southern enclaves. So when you say no voting on Sunday, you're basically saying yes, no Black church vote. And that's a significant part of the vote. The Georgia Republicans are not just shameless, they are flagrant. Right? None of this is happening in the dark, by the way.
Oh, no, they're introducing this legislation in the Georgia State House. They're proud of this legislation.
And they're not the only ones. So there are about 100 bills across state legislatures that are controlled by Republicans right now that have various types and degrees of proposed voting restrictions. Republicans think they cannot win without suppressing the vote. And here's the thing, political scientists will tell you they are right.
Yeah. They know that voter suppression is the only way to go because they, in fact, have very unpopular policies that
That's the thing.
You know, or they their policies serve a really small portion of the electorate. And it's weird that they have millions of people, tens of millions of people, really, that are like, yeah, I'm actually OK with the suppression that you want to put on me. I'm fine with that as long as you guys keep Black people in line and women in their place.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see just how unpopular their ideas are, how half-assed. And then they're like, you know what? We know we can't win hearts and minds. And so we're just going to destroy those hearts and minds.
Yeah. When you see somebody like Ted Cruz or something out there and you're like trying to figure that guy out. First of all, there's nothing to figure out. He is exactly what he looks like.
But he is who he says he is. Yeah, like, believe him. He is that motherfucker that goes to Cancun when his state is in crisis.
And the worst part to me, I'm sorry, is then comes back and blames his children. If you want to talk about somebody's moral core,
You know what, Tressie, let's talk about this just a little bit. Just a little bit. Did you see what those people on his group text did?
Yes, I did.
I mean, the group text is sacred. So that means his people hate him.
And they don't just hate him. They hate him and his wife.
His wife is trash,
too. Oh, yeah.
Because they normally you would think they would band around her.
Exactly.
Because she's married to him.
She's married to the asshole.
And they're all like, $300 a night at the Ritz-Carlton. It says so right here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They flamed him and her, which I thought said a lot about their place in their little local elite enclave. Mm-hmm. She clearly does the day-to-day work of the cruise brand around that town, and they cannot stand her ass.
People always think that these political wives are like innocent victims. And I'm like, frankly, they're generally more lethal than their husbands. They are the ones who are about it.
Let me tell you something a friend told me years ago that I never forgot. Mm-hmm. She said, Tressie, I was talking about a mismatch coupling in our like friend group. And I was like, yeah, because like the guy was a total pothead. And among other things, I'm being kind here. I think there was some coke in there. There was a lot happening there, but we call it pothead. Mm-hmm. And he had hooked up with this girl who we thought of as being like really, you know, pristine sort of middle-class princess. And my friend turned to me and said, Tressie, crackheads don't marry non-crackheads. You might not know what she's doing, but the fact that they are in that house alone together, he is not the only person getting high. I think of that with political couples all the time. Ooh, yes. Why you think you would have the devil, the political devil sitting there and he's married to an angel? Mm-hmm. That's just not how that works.
You know what? Proverb, Tressie, crackheads do not marry non-crackheads. So it is written, so it shall be.
She blew my mind. Jade, if you're listening, I give you all the credits. We're big on credits in my friendships. I was so angry and like, I don't know, disappointed in people when they were making that case about Melania Trump. When Donald Trump was first elected, they painted her as this victim.
Oh, I know. This poor little victim in Trump Tower just biding her time.
Mm-hmm. That is not how that works.
Never. No. Ever. And later on, like years later, I think in the past year, I read an article that said that he and Melania actually get along fairly well, that they are of a same mind, and that he goes to her for counsel, which means that she fuels a lot of his really fascist tendencies.
Yes.
There is no need to have any empathy for her. She's A, getting paid, and B, exactly where the fuck she wants to be.
Thank you.
So we have all these political couples who are doing these really terrible things together, and we and they deserve to share the load of that.
That's
Let's
right.
implicate them both. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're seeing similar kinds of dastardly behavior at the state legislature level.
Yeah.
They are up to no good. Mm-hmm. Today, we actually have a really great guest to help us make sense of a lot of the factors that are at play when it comes to one of the most pernicious evils in politics, which is voter suppression. And that is Brittany Gibson. She is a journalist covering voting rights for the American Prospect and the Pulitzer Center. Hi, Brittany.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. We're excited to get into this.
Absolutely.
So give us a sense of the scope of what Republicans are up to, because I suspect that they are up to absolutely no good.
Yes, you would be right on that. So, you know, even though the 2020 cycle is over, we should think of this as in terms of the 2021 legislative cycle beginning. Mm-hmm. So in state houses around the country, there have been more than 200 bills that are either carried over or being introduced.
Oh, we're at 200. Okay, over 200.
Yes, in January, it was more than 100. Mm-hmm. Now we're up to, I think it's about 250 now, of bills that would restrict people's voting rights around the country, all in different ways. You can
I was just about to say, what's the scope of some of these bills that you are seeing?
Well, I think Georgia is the perfect example of good, you know, anecdote for what's happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's most of the bills I've seen are pretty big attacks on the absentee system. Mm-hmm. So think of things like requiring witness signatures on absentee mail-in ballots. Mm-hmm. Think about things like requiring early voting, early in-person ahead of Election Day, centers to have reduced hours or no voting on Sunday, as you just mentioned, things like that. So most of what I'm seeing now is attacking the alternatives, which really helped boost the turnout in 2020.
Right. That was the big horse race there at the end, right? They, I remember, what's our little guy, Willie? No, what's the guy from MSNBC, the political analyst that you love, Roxy, with his khaki pants?
Steve Kornacki.
Steve Kornacki, that's it. I remember Steve using, you know, he has this board and he keeps going, this doesn't include the absentee mail-in. That was the big mushy middle, right? Everything was in there. So we're seeing lots of bills that are attacking what ended up being a real vote-getting place for Democrats. Okay.
It's interesting because it doesn't have to necessarily be that way. It doesn't have to be the place where Democrats are getting their votes.
True.
That was a factor of, you know, Trump saying, my voters, hello, please do not go vote in this way. Mm-hmm. Specifically go vote in person on Election Day. So it's one of those things where expansion could actually help Republican voters. If you're a Republican voter over 65 and it's easier for you to vote by mail or vote early when there's less lines or, you know, whatever things could happen on Election Day, this expansions can help you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny you should say that because earlier, Tressie and I were talking about how Republicans are going for voter suppression because they have such unpopular policies. And it's so interesting that even when they have this opportunity to capitalize on their base and encourage their base to get out to vote, they're like, no, no, thank you. We actually just are not interested in using democracy as a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing about all of the bills that are coming out of Georgia right now, because their absentee system was actually designed by Republican Governor Sonny Perdue.
Right.
Just 15 years ago, one thing that's being attacked right now is the no absentee reasoning rule, if that makes sense. So in some states, you have to have a pre-approved state reason for why you'd like to vote absentee. And Governor Brian Kemp and Secretary of State Raffensperger have just come out, or in the last few months, I should say, saying that that system doesn't make any sense. But they're actually, by saying that, attacking fellow Republicans, former Trump cabinet member, and the system that he put into place.
Because when they were designing it at the time, they had a very solid gerrymandered plan. Right. So the other thing that's sort of happened here has been very successful counterattacks at the court level of gerrymandered districts across the nation, right? So they felt more secure doing that sort of like mail-in ballot to appeal to things like elderly voters who do tend to lean more conservative when the gerrymandered maps were, you know, defensible. Now that those seem to be not unilaterally defensible in the court level, now we have a question about whether or not the system works, right? What kinds of things are people doing on the ground, both at the activist level, but also in things like, are we filing court cases yet? Like, who's got their eye on the ball with all of these over 200 bills?
Absolutely. Activists and organizers, the usual groups you'd think of, Brennan Center, ACLU, Legal Defense Fund, they're definitely on this in terms of national and legal efforts. But one thing that's been really interesting, and sorry to keep going back to Georgia, because that state is so well organized and so politically charged and motivated. What they did when these bills were first introduced was put basically a call out to all of their supporters. So groups like, you know, your local NAACP and ACLU chapters, in addition to groups like New Georgia Project, the local Common Cause, all of those groups, they basically said, these bills are not set in stone yet. They're just introductions. So we need you to continue to stay motivated, continue to stay engaged, call your state representatives, tell them how this would affect your voting. And the fact that there's not a lot of reason behind the restrictive bills, and if people are hearing from their constituents, you know, the letters, the emails, the calls, that could sway some people to vote against these bills. At least that's the optimistic
version. Yeah, I was
going to
say, that's encouraging. Yeah. I wish there was more that we could do other than, because every time there are these calls to call your representative, I wonder, is that really effective? And I know that in many instances it is, but it makes you feel disempowered to know that this is really the only choice that you have. I think it's also important that we start to think about these issues on the federal level. And I know that in Congress, there is the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that might help voting rights across the country?
The way the U.S. system works right now is there are basically 50 mini federal elections, all with different systems, all with different procedures. You can live in California and vote one way and move to Alabama, and all of a sudden you can't vote that way anymore.
Yep.
And the last time we had a federal response was after Bush v. Gore, after 2000 and the Help America Vote Act. So it's been a while since the federal government, or at least Congress, looked at this. So one of the things that the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would do that would have the largest impact on people right away is it would bring back in something called preclearance. Preclearance was a part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was struck down by a 2013 Supreme Court decision. And it basically said if you are a state or certain counties as well that have a history of suppressing people's votes, making it difficult for people to vote either based on their race or language requirements or, you know, physical disabilities, whatever it might be, before you change any laws or procedures to your elections, we need to review it and just double check that it doesn't have bias against people, that it's not going to affect certain minorities. And that's not there anymore. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act would bring that in. And so a lot of the voting rights experts and lawyers that I've spoken to said, you know, if preclearance was still around, we wouldn't even see a lot of these bills. But another thing that I think gets lost or not talked about as much is there are some changes to election procedures that don't go through larger bills or legislation. For example, on election day, changing polling places. That's not a law that has to be passed or anything like that. It's really at a granular county level. But back when preclearance was there, that would have had to been reported. And that just makes it so much easier for grassroots activists as well as the national, you know, big guns that can go straight to the courts to, you know, help people on just an everyday level.
Right, right. Preclearance is, I think of that as the last grandstand, the loss of preclearance, which turned on a Supreme Court decision that said we had worked through our voting rights suppression instinct, right? Like this was a historic relic. It didn't exist anymore, right? And it had created unnecessary administrative burden and it was fine, right? And then almost immediately thereafter, I do love that the, you know, history is over. And then almost immediately thereafter, every civic human right in this country was immediately re-legislated through a Voting Rights Act. So the loss of the Voting Rights Act cannot be overstated, not just, by the way, for Black voters. I think sometimes we miss that. Like, I really appreciate you pointing out that mattered for Americans with Disabilities Act implications. It mattered for people with who do not speak English as their primary language. It mattered to so many voters.
Yeah, and what you just said about history being over is the rationale behind it. The way that case got brought up to the Supreme Court, sorry if this is too in the weeds, but it came from Shelby County, Alabama. Alabama already passed a voter ID law. They just hadn't implemented it. But after that Supreme Court case, it was 24 hours later, they implemented their voter ID law.
That's the kind of
so
thing.
That was,
so they did not waste
they
any didn't, time.
They did not.
Yeah.
And
shady.
And you'll probably hear that states have created these alternatives. Get a free voter ID card.
Right.
We have a van that goes around. They had to do those measures because right after they passed that voter ID law, they just so happened to close down DMV stations in counties that had majority Black populations.
Yeah. I mean, we saw after the last election, I mean, I remember seeing reporting there were some DMVs that were open for like one day a week. So here's the thing that I do want to put out there, because this is one of those wonky things that I'm not sure lands always with us emotionally when we hear it. And it's important to point out when everybody's talking about the filibuster, the filibuster, the filibuster, filibuster matters a lot to voting suppression and our ability to respond to it. Can you tell us a little bit about how that would relate to like the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill? What the possibility is of it with the filibuster?
Absolutely. I'm generally an optimist in terms of things getting done, especially in terms of voting rights. You can't talk to grassroots activists and not walk away feeling, you know, positive about things. But because of the filibuster, I don't see how you can get Republicans to, you know, vote past that, to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, despite the fact that I'm sure the House could pass it with their majority. Joe Biden at least seems to be motivated. I probably had more hope ahead of January 6th, but if, you know, Senators Cruz and Hawley are willing to not want to certify Electoral College results, I could see them tag teaming a filibuster on this. It doesn't, currently doesn't seem likely.
That was very optimistic of you, though.
We appreciate just a little drop of optimism. Because when you look at the landscape, and I imagine as a journalist who's, you know, enmeshed in all of this, it can seem pretty grim and overwhelming.
Yes, I think the big picture, definitely. But I've, you know, been really lucky enough to do a lot of on the ground reporting. And the people that are doing the most ground level work, whether they're connected to a larger organization, New Georgia Project or ACLU, or if they're just individual people. I met a fantastic organizer from Sumter, South Carolina.
Her
name is Dr. Brenda C. Williams, and she just goes out of her way. She's a retired physician. She just goes out of her way to register people to vote, drive them to the polls. She used to go into...
I know so many women who have done that over the years.
Exactly.
So many.
And so when you talk to those people that are really just combating the system on an individual person-by-person level, it's impossible not to feel, you know, optimistic about things being able to move forward.
Thank you for that gift, Brittany. And thank you for joining us here on Here to Slay. It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for all of your great work and your reporting on this. I hope that we won't have to have you reporting on it indefinitely. How about that?
Yes. It would be great if you could get a new beat simply because this one has disappeared.
I agree. Yep. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, she was surprisingly optimistic, which frankly I appreciated because I tend to get, it's not that I give up, but when I look at the way politics are and what a dirty business they are and the things that politicians on all sides of the aisle, frankly, are willing to do and what they're willing to compromise to push their agendas, it can be really disheartening and dispiriting.
Yeah. I have been accused before of being a pessimist, and I always say, no, I practice in the Black feminist tradition of pragmatism, but I admit that that can sound quite pessimistic. And so I appreciated Brittany managing to be both pragmatic and upbeat. And you know what I attribute that to, Roxanne?
Youth?
Yes, that helps. Did you see her glowing?
I mean, my God, I was like, look at the little shine in her eye.
I know. My eyes haven't been that white since 1984. But I also attribute that to something she said about talking to people. You know, we've been isolated for a really long time, and I cannot ever be confused with a people person. But I am a writer and I'm an ethnographer and I love to listen to people. And Brittany reminded me of why that is. It is really hard to be a fatalist, a nihilist, when you actually talk to people.
Yes.
It really is. That's why I think the work, when like activists talk about how important it is to like get off of freaking social media or to turn off the television, especially like the news shows, you know, and they're like, you need to go outside and talk to some people. Right? That's like activism and collective politics 101. Go talk to some people. And I think that's one of the most important things that young Black activists have especially reminded us of the last like 5 years with Black Lives Matter and Occupy, I think even before that, which is like how much better you actually feel when you go listen to actual people.
Because you see them doing what we always, you know, call the work.
Right.
And they're not just talking about it. And when you recognize that there are people on the ground, and it, I do too trace it back to Occupy, which was for at least our generation. You know, that was like this really mass movement. At the time I was teaching at Eastern Illinois University, and there was a little Occupy encampment on campus, these little kids in their tents, and they were sincere about it. They were like, we may be in Charleston, Illinois, but we're about it. And I really admire that. And so many young activists are doing this work. In fact, we get to have a conversation with one of these young Black activists. She's a woman. She's exciting. Her name is Amber J. Phillips. And she is a writer, a storyteller, a reproductive rights activist and organizer who lives in California. And she seems to have boundless energy for this.
I know. I cannot even fathom what it is like to be that awake anymore. Listen, I love Amber. Y'all, I've just got to tell you, I tune into Amber on Instagram like it's television. We're going to drop her Instagram in the show notes. It is my gift to you. Mm-hmm. Go watch Amber Phillips on Instagram. She entertains me to no end and teaches me. I love, love, love having cohort members across the age spectrum. You know, a person doesn't have to be a certain age to teach you something. And Amber teaches me all the time. We got into a lot of stuff in this interview, but we started by talking about the way Black people in particular have been engaged politically.
Typically, when we engage Black folks and communities of color or low-income communities, any communities that are outside of the Beltway, it's this assumption that they're going to vote Democrat or they're going mm-hmm. to vote for on the right side of history. But as a Black girl who is embedded in Black communities, I know that we deserve actual political education. Like,
Not
just fill out your voter registration card, but
and show up every 2 years.
Exactly.
And,
exactly. And I'm like, I can't leave that work up to like Charlemagne the God, you know, I'm dropping. You can tell me what I can and can't say.
No, you have actually touched on a pet peeve of mine. I have many issues with Charlemagne, the not God. And that
what is it, Lenard?
It is Lenard.
Lenard. Yes. We keep outsourcing political education to entertainers. Mm-hmm. And I understand that might, and I've said this also about feminism, the superstar is the door. And that's fine. We need people to walk through that door. I embrace it. But what we have to give them more than just the door.
Yeah.
We have to give them a place to walk into where we actually educate people on policy and not tell them what to think. Just tell them what the options are.
Mm-hmm.
And that we don't do this, that we're so, not we, but that they are so condescending to Black voters, Latino voters, to a lesser extent, Asian voters, that they just say, you should vote for us because we're not them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I just keep thinking you're going to actually need a better argument than that if you really want to sustain a Black vote, if you really want to capitalize on, say, what happened in Georgia. Thing.
And not even just a Black vote, but Black leadership. We only talk about these communities in terms of what they can contribute to these establishments as if it's not our grandparents and our aunties who are embedded in Black communities, who are my grandmother ran the food bank at my church, right? Like, there's this assumption that all Black people agree on how policing should work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's
yeah,
this assumption the that all of us are clear about what reproductive justice is. There's an assumption that we're clear about what kind of supports and policies Black queer folks need. Mm-hmm. And when we're reduced down to a vote during presidentials or midterm elections, all of us miss out on the visionary possibilities or the political leadership of Black folks at the local level, at the family level, as well as how that can impact national politics. So I love that about we leave it up to celebrity or we build political superstars only to reduce them down to a couple of talking points or a message box.
Okay, so now that you said that, you know what I got to ask you about? We've got a new crop of political superstars. Some people want to start with AOC, but I think what we really are talking about now is Cori Bush, or we're really talking about the new freshman class who is often thought of as knowing exactly these narratives that you talk about. And I sometimes get in trouble. It's fine. I'm living. I get in trouble for not being as enthusiastic as people expect and really obligate Black women to be in public. They want to consume our emotions. I have to perform being enthusiastic. I have to perform being faithful, right? Hopeful, because that's how other people feel it. They consume it from us. But I think that there has to be a way to go, okay, you can see this thing happening, but still have your eye on the ball of the larger political picture. As somebody who has organized, who has been in both like local and nonprofit spaces, especially during this, you know, Trumpian years, but also the Black Lives Matter years of trying to figure out how they were going to relate to electoral politics. What's your read on our emerging Black political superstar class?
I think it's exciting to see Black folks running for office and holding mm-hmm. leadership.
Yep.
I think sometimes when we talk about politics, we separate or we only think about electoral politics. We don't mm-hmm. also look at how nonprofit organizing falls into that. Like when I moved to D.C., everyone in my family thought I worked at the White House. I did not. Mm-hmm. I've only been there once. mm-hmm. So as an example, but I think what when I think of specifically about like Ayanna Pressley.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. she was doing like sex education around for Black women and girls. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. Right. And mm-hmm. my hope is that as these folks are entering into these upper echelon power structures, that they're able to carry those threads. And really, I want us to listen to what they're saying. If that makes sense. Like, I really want us to, again, it goes back to this political education thing. I don't want to see Stacey Abrams and not ask real questions about her policy stances. I don't want to see these folks and then not say, okay, what are you doing around Hyde, repealing the Hyde Amendment? And I think sometimes representation can kind of do a doozy on you. We're seeing this with Kamala mm-hmm. Harris, right? It's like, ooh, yeah. be excited she's a Black woman, but it's like, okay, but what about that policing record, girl? Mm-hmm. Like, how are we redistributing wealth in the form of these stimulus packages? How are we doing all that work? That's what I really want people to ask them.
No, you raise a good point. One of the most frustrating things is I'm very interested in the squad and then the people who entered this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish more people would talk to them about policy. Lauren Underwood moved mm-hmm. forward with her maternal health, her Black maternal health initiative. And very few people are actually talking about it. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. talk about, oh, diversity, there's diversity in Congress and so on. But like, what are they actually doing? What kinds of policy initiatives are they doing? And AOC, I actually find her interesting. I like her. One of the things that's interesting about her is that she does, on a granular level, try to explain what's going on.
Teach people. Policy. She does. Yeah.
She does try to teach people and sort of open up the mysteries of Congress. And mm-hmm. I wish that more people of color had the platform to do that.
Yeah.
Or the space. Like, I think what AOC is doing with social media. So I also did a lot of digital organizing when I was in D.C. Mm-hmm. And a big push that I will always make was to be honest about where we are and to really show these processes. So when AOC mm-hmm. got elected, I was super excited about how she was using Instagram Live. She showed us the behind mm-hmm. the scenes of her first swearing in. And sometimes Black women, we feel so pressured on how we show up that we can mm-hmm. tend to only show up when everything's just right. And I think they, a lot of them do have the platform. If we're thinking about the use of digital media outside of things like the Washington Post and Politico and mm-hmm. giving comment, that they actually do have the power to speak directly to audiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what AOC has done so well, is she's clear about her role in politics, but she's also clear about how she's showing up in culture. And that's the piece that I think a lot of Black electeds really could dive more into.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm thinking about my entry point into politics, the first thing when you decide that you might want to run for office one day is mm-hmm. you start cleaning everything up, right?
That's right.
You start
cleaning out that Twitter.
Exactly. You just start to become less of who you are and really just only talking about the work. And I was, mm-hmm. and it made me a very uptight college student, I must say. I wish I would have had more fun. That's why I'm kind of pissed about this quarantine is because I turned 30 Fair. And I was like, I wanted to be out here, you know. So
yeah, no, it's undermining. It's undermining some good whole summers. Yeah. Let's be honest about that.
Whole summer is just gone.
Come September, if Biden really follows through on this 300 million vaccine thing, if it actually happens, God. And yes. they say it's going to happen by the end of July, we'll see. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But if it happens, I think the fall, we are going to be filthy, filthy people.
Oh, my God.
Skies out. People are going to lose their minds.
Naked. Like,
let me tell you, as somebody who had, I had my good fair share of hoe days. I really did. I did it when you were supposed to do it, and I'm going to do it again. If we can ever leave the house without feeling like that pressure of the hawk on your back.
Yes.
Let me just tell you something. My friends and I, we're going to Carnival.
I'm going to all the events where minimal clothing is required. Yes,
that is correct. I'm asking my people down in Mississippi if they know a juke joint. Oh, I'm asking people I want a juke joint.
That's right. Dirty,
I want it bad.
Dark.
Yes.
Little dirty glasses.
Yes.
Dark liquor.
I don't want no Cosmo.
Sexy ass music.
I don't want the hells. Yeah. I want an Incredible Hulk in a dirty glass and to be pressed up against a wall that still got sticky
sweating
paper on it.
Period.
Yes. I want to get pregnant from dancing. Yes. I hear you. That's correct.
And I literally cannot wait. So as somebody who even had her whole days, I am so sorry for everybody whose really grand whole days are being interrupted by this whole COVID nonsense. So before we move on to more important things like our whole days, I just got to say this respectability thing that you talk about with how afraid we are to perform our real selves when we are political people. It also happens, I think, in our professional lives, no matter whether it's politics or not. Like the thing about being a good, respectable Black woman is you immediately, you start putting on the drag, right?
Yes.
You got to present this certain face. And like, I'm really empathetic to that because I think AOC has, frankly, some privileges she can draw on.
Definitely.
That somebody like Ayanna Pressley cannot.
Definitely.
Right? People are there to attack a Black woman for just waking up in the morning.
Breathing.
And if she were to like crack a joke on Instagram, I honestly think they'd send out the National Guard. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Having said that, I do think that with everything burning down, like risk it anyway.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
When I hear people talk about my Instagram, even my mother,
mm-hmm.
especially my mom, because, you know, I look like her throughout time. So she's looking like, oh, this is my life. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. She calls me her best thing. So
my mom calls me that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm her best thing. Yeah.
it's
a trap, Roxanne. Yo. Don't fall for it. It's a trap.
It's a trap.
She want to move into my house. She'll call me anything.
Mama is waiting on me to create a tiny. When that Netflix or HBO moment happens, she's like, build me a tiny house. I was like, girl, you ain't going to stay in no tiny house in the backyard.
Thank you.
So there's that.
Listen, I'm going to tell you a quick story.
As somebody whose
parents live in the tiny house in the backyard, let me tell you, my mom is already like, I need 3 bedrooms, Roxanne. And I'm just like...
That's definitely going to be my mother for sure.
She does not disappoint.
She's going to want expansion. No. She's definitely going to want it to expand.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what I really am team. Take up as much space as you possibly can. Be yourself. Like it sounds like so frivolous, but as someone who is constantly trying to practice being my full self, you really don't know even how far it can go until you start the process.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I got my hair colored, like when I decided to really commit to my uniform of crop tops. Like and my favorite moment with my lover, I love a crop top, was when I had to, before the pandemic, I had to present in DC and I was presenting on political narratives and I wore a crop top and some wide leg pants and that's what she gave.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just feel like a lot of these spaces weren't meant for me regardless, even if I am in the perfect
even
and tailored
dress. Even if you put on the drag, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Even if I put on the drag, I am never them.
Mm-hmm.
So I may as well be fully myself because I am not only more comfortable, but here's the thing that I don't think we give enough value to. I'm having a good time.
I'm really mm-hmm. having a ball.
Yes.
And the reality is, this is when I think about the folks who I bring into rooms with me, when I talk mm-hmm. about Black voters or Black audiences, mm-hmm. I'm them. You know, like, I'm right. not going to separate myself from that.
That's it.
When you're organizing or you're coming into organizing work, people will say, find your political home, find your political mm-hmm. home. I spent most of my 20s finding this political home and mm-hmm. really just not fitting in the way I assumed to I would fit in, because I'm like, oh, we all agree, right? And it's like, no. Even mm-hmm. in Black spaces, I'm a dark-skinned, fat Black girl, right?
That's
and that
right.
comes with
yep.
its own set of challenges. But my goal for folks is, how can you become your own political home? How can you start with self to really not just talk about Black feminism, but enact it in your life? Mm. How are you thinking differently about your family structures? I refer to my auntie, myself as an auntie, literally. I'm an aunt. And sometimes when we talk about parenting people or people who are raising kids, I'm left out of that narrative. But the reality is, I'm a critical part of my sister's children's life, mm-hmm. right? And I want that to be honored. And I started to include it more because I'll read bios from like people who are mothers, and they're like, I'm a mother of three. And I'm like, well, I'm an auntie of two.
Yeah.
You know, because that's also a part of my political framework.
Let me just tell you, I started doing that at some point earlier in my career, where I would list the women who had made me in my bio, right? Mm-hmm. I'm O'Rell's granddaughter, Vivian's daughter, right? Da, da, da. And I had a white woman come up to me after a talk. So this is post lower ed, pre thick. So I'm in a, you know, I got enough to be feeling myself, but I still need to keep a job. You know what I'm saying? That was the moment.
And you can go off, but not off.
There you go. Just that context is important. And I knew her. She was not a stranger. So, like, this is somebody who, if anybody should have, you know, had a better read on who and what I am, is my point. And I will never forget this woman coming up to me after a talk I gave and said, just so you know, you're never going to get anywhere in life until you let go of that whole, your whole mother problem.
A mother problem?
Yes, right. Yes, right.
Oh, I'm just sorry, but that's not how you know she was white and that she has not met Miss Vivian yet, because—
Thank you.
Whew, Lord,
or any other kind of a Miss Vivian, because, I mean, this was so foreign to my understanding of how you even navigate the fucking world as a human being. And I thought, I have heard about your wayward, drug-addicted son for 10 years. Mm. I know all that boy's business. He wrecked the car. He's da-da-da-da. But somehow, when I say I'm someone's daughter, I'm the one with the narrative problem. And I started to understand that there was no narrative that I, as a Black woman, that was going to have that wasn't going to piss off, for the record, some white person somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Or some man somewhere.
There is enough
That's
to
right.
incite them.
Yeah. So if anything, I have doubled down, like you, with like being an aunt. I'm like, yes, I'm an aunt. I'm a mm-hmm. godmother. I'm a this and I'm a that. Because what I really think they have a problem with is the fact that we're something other than an appendage of them.
Right. Correct. That we care for people other than, for example, our readership. Because
exactly.
I do find, and this seems to be unique to Black women, and I would say also Latinx women.
Mm-hmm.
And Native American women, when we develop a following, however modest that following might be, people tend to believe that that is our primary thing that we have to caretake. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I actually don't caretake you at all. I write, you read, we engage mm-hmm. perhaps. And, you know, but I'm Nicole's daughter and Michael's daughter first mm-hmm. and last and always, whether I'm happy with them or not. And you know, it's something I think that, you know, there's this fundamental difference, and it's a cultural difference about mm-hmm. what we prioritize. And this actually ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation about how white people are excited for the political so-and-so to start up mm-hmm. again while we are exhausted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's because we have bonds, like we have things that excite us and that nurture us and nourish us and that we nurture and nourish beyond the political. Like,
mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see the absence I actually feel quite sad for them.
Yeah.
And at the very end of the day, these are the people who will take care of us regardless of if that readership there or not. Regardless of if we get the promotions and the raises, mm-hmm. I go back to Carol Phillips and cry about this shit. I'm always amazed too how there's this illusion that can be presented to, especially to smart Black girls, that somehow mm-hmm. once we go through college and we get these jobs that we are supposed to like separate from our families. Like,
now they're
over there and we're over here.
Yeah.
And the thing that I love, I'm also a twin. The thing that I have valued across time.
I'm like, how did I not know that?
Hannah's mom. That's why Hannah is so similar. My niece is so similar to me.
Okay.
Even though we're fraternal twins, I really feel like my sister had my child.
Yeah, she just mm-hmm. incubated your baby. Exactly. I get that.
So, but I think that's kind of the narrative that I got as a kid too. Like when you're smart, you have to separate from everybody.
Right.
Positioning our families as not only our support system, but for me, really a muse, and mm-hmm. they are who I take this stuff back to. If mm-hmm. they don't get it, then I'm not going to keep moving in that direction. And this is, I value education. I value knowledge creation, but I also want them to be a part of that. I don't want to stay too far in a place where they cannot enter.
That's right. Everywhere I go, my family can be.
Absolutely.
I remember my mom coming to my mother has come to many of my academic talks. And what I love is very early on in my graduate school career, she made a concerted effort to understand the career, right? Yep. She was like, okay, she'd come to me and she'd go, now, wait a minute. She said, because my mama can pick up on a shade. She may not understand the particulars, but she gets politics, small p, very well. Mm-hmm. And she'd go like, I didn't like the way that person said so-and-so's title, what was happening there, you know? And so she made a concerted effort and to understand like what my research was about. And so my mom's come to my talks, my niece comes to mm-hmm. my talks and my book events. And I say to them, and my mom can get really sort of cagey because not all of my family members know how to act in public. And so she'll go, you sure you want Aunt Jean to come? And I'm like, listen, if I'm there and Aunt Jean can't be there, I'm not there. Mm. So now to be fair, Aunt Jean shows her ass every single time. The last time she came to a book event, for whatever reason, she had decided that day to have a Jamaican accent.
Okay.
All right. Yes, that's what I'm telling you.
You know what? All right.
Exactly.
What we're doing.
God bless her. She shows her ass every time, but I refuse to be embarrassed by my people. This is what we do.
Yeah,
this is what we do.
And I don't know if y'all feel this way too about, I'm thinking about your essay, Know Your Whites. But even all these years that I've been doing this work, when I have a real problem with how to navigate whiteness, my mother mm-hmm. gives me the best advice.
Hands down, every time.
And it's been like that since I was a kid. One time mm-hmm. I decided that I wanted to work a job and like make extra money. And I applied for a pharmacy position, which how did I get to do that at 18?
Yeah, I did that when CBS. I was 17.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness. I did the same thing. Yeah.
But
I was a pharmacy tech.
Yes. I applied for a job at CVS in the pharmacy. And you know, they used to do those tests about like, it's like a morality test. Like,
if you need
10 mm-hmm. cents, do you grab it from the cash register or do you like, basically asking you a bunch of questions of, will you steal from us? And I remember taking the test and I was like, Mom, what is this? I don't know how to take this test. And she goes, answer it like a white person. I was like, okay.
There you go.
And I answered the questions. Yeah. And when I went into the interview, they were like, you really scored high on this, test. So much so, they're like, you scored really high on this test. Would you mind taking it again? And that's when I know I couldn't do it. I couldn't do that particular job because mm-hmm. already I was coming in.
Yep.
I'm like, I don't have to be a rocket scientist to do this.
About your mother. Your mother understood the test because your mom had been taking a version of that test her whole life. That's why our parents know. That's right. They've mm-hmm. been taking that test, whether it was on paper or not.
Yeah.
They've been taking a version of the how white are you test their whole lives.
Yeah.
And she knew exactly what that was.
She knew what it was. So when I come to her with a problem with like, these huge entities, she's like, oh, do this, like, think about it like this, or don't let people treat you like this, or this is a moment where it's absolutely okay for you to stand up for yourself. We all say it, you know, they say it differently, but you got to decode it.
That's right.
Sprinkle some on it, because they'll have you in there going off in the boardroom, okay? So that to me, that I want to make sure they're good, and I want to create political practices and culture. You talk about political education being left to superstars, and I think what I know for sure is I have grown into this personality of being able to do both, being able to exist in this political space, in this cultural space. And I think my goal with a lot of this stuff, or with who I'm becoming as a storyteller, as someone who is an activist who cares about certain issues, is an entry point to, and sometimes a little sneaky entry point, because some of the spaces I show up in, like the Breakfast Club, when I was on there, it's like, you're expected to do one thing, and I can grab you with a joke, or with humor, or with a good story, and then I'm like, well, have you heard about bell hooks? You know, like,
trying
to transition people into believing themselves. I think that's I want Black, specifically Black women, to believe what they're going through, to really know that it's not just us, that there are systems at play, that there are things happening around us, that it's not like whether or not you wore the right length skirt or whether or not you had a handkerchief to cover your legs or not. Like, I want us to understand that there's all these things at play. That's why it's so important for us to enter as we are. That's the ultimate goal.
You really have touched on something I think that's so crucial, and that we've been talking about in different ways, that we live in the world as we are, and where we come from and who we come from. How do we encourage people of color, Black people in particular, to be comfortable enough to be in the world as we are? Because there are so many messages that we receive that we have to compromise our Blackness. We have to fix our hair because there's something wrong with it. You know, it's overwhelming. And so when I see the lost Black people who have given over to white supremacy, I'm not as much angry as I am sad, because I know that they just gave up. And so how do you keep your head up? How do you do this? And what can other people learn to how to in terms of how to do that?
Yeah, it is a giving up. That's I think going back to a piece of this, which is joy, I think we have to demonstrate it. I think sometimes we don't know until we know. We don't know until we see it. Last night, my really good friend, Jasmine Walker, who I did a podcast with called the Black Joy Mixtape. She had me watch this documentary called The Aggressives, which is about butch lesbians and studs and trans masculine folks. And one of the storylines was, this person felt like they were a tomboy their whole life, and then they went to the village and they saw women who presented as butch, and they went home and cut their hair. And I think that I can point to so many moments where I have seen something that I did not know was possible, and then realized that's who I am. That's what it is. So I think that as storytellers, as creators, our job is to put a light on all these different ways of being and being that as well. I think initially I was talking to someone else about this show, and I was like, when I think about joy, I think about like, you all are writers, you're geniuses, and you're really contributing to culture in this way. But then I love the Instagram content that you make around cooking, Roxanne. Like, there are times when, like, you literally don't know where this is going to go, and you're like, tastes great. And I'm like, it's so, it's so small, but it's so important to see that part of your personality. That, you will read down white supremacy and bake a bread that might not look good, but it tastes good. It tastes good. Chessie, your love of like decor, like very Southern decor style of like, I think about your book party. That was one of my favorite, again, a moment where I'm like, oh, we can do this. Like, you know, at Barnes and Noble's,
I know. Yeah, and we don't.
It's very low.
Yeah, and I don't do that.
Yeah, there was like a ham there and whiskey.
That options, sure as shit was.
And shrimp and grits. And I'm just like, what? Yeah.
You come to a Tressie book party, you will be fed. You will dance.
Period.
Yeah, daggone straight, you will. We don't play that. I looked around at all of those. I've gone to my fair share and we'll go to them again. It's fine. But if it's my party,
it's going to be a party.
My party should feel like me.
Yeah.
So I feel like what you're saying to us is that if life is this party and if this is our party, it should feel like us.
Yeah. I mean, you literally get to pick everything out. Like,
you really do.
This is your space. Really,
and I also hear you saying role models.
Yes.
And not in the cheesy way, but when you see people like living their truth, when you see Tressie having a kick-ass book party or, you know, my little Instagram, you know that this is a possibility that I did not think was a possibility.
Yeah, you can have a spiral ham at a book party. If you learn nothing else from me, people, this is what I want you to know.
You know what? Let me get my
say that person. You can absolutely
post
have
this shit.
A spiral ham. Those people will lie to you and tell you that people don't do it. Ham goes everywhere,
ham,
honey.
It does. You can pick it up. True.
And ham
put
is
it on
delicious.
A cute little wood board.
Ham keeps. Okay, they were telling me all this stuff. I said, first of all, everything you have described, that does not keep. Ham keeps. You can put ham in your purse and it'll be fine an hour later. So I'm just saying, respect the spiral ham. Listen, Amber, Jay Fellas, we've got a question we'd like to ask everybody, but especially Black women who come in the show. Are you ready?
Yes.
Tell us how we can help you do you.
Ooh.
Roxanne and I, the show, the audience, how can we help Amber do you?
Wow, such an excellent. One, the fact that you all see me is just chef's kiss. Like, I wish I had more words, but to be seen by other people is an honor. And to be named by them is always an honor. I think about how in the past, as much as I talk about the erasure of Black women and femmes, I know that I'm speaking about that because that's often how I have felt. I have felt like my work isn't good enough unless it's coming off the lips of someone else. Or a lot of spaces or work that, a movement work that I contribute to or creative work that I contribute to, it's assumed that that's just what Black girls do, right? We're not always named as the creative inspiration or the genius behind some of the culture that we spark. And I think how folks can help me is I love engaging with folks who are like, this inspired me to do this, or this is how I was able to carry on the work that you're doing. So I think naming is really important to me right now. I'm working on releasing a project, and
that's
how
exciting.
Folks can help me is like, just stay tuned. If you're already engaged on my Instagram, stay there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, do it. I think that I'm invested in building context around my experience as a Black girl, and any support of that, naming of that is always excellent. I really, y'all will be some of the first people I share it with, to be honest.
I was about to say, let us know.
Yeah, I would love that. So I think there's that piece. And then there's so much stuff that will tell us no, but I want y'all to keep going because I get so many no's. I take a lot of L's in quiet, but I hope that whatever no's that you all get, that you keep going. I'm like, this is all praise, but like when it came across I look at the MacArthur Genius Grants every year and I'm like, oh shit, can I cuss?
Let it out. Let it out.
When I saw your being on that, I was like, oh wow, may this continue. May it get even more specific about the details and lives of Black women, Black girls, Black queer folks, Black trans people, because I don't want us to go another decade believing that we don't exist. I just want to be in it for years and years and years, for generations and generations and generations. So that's how folks can help. Just stay tuned and please keep creating, keep sharing these thoughts because we need them. Hannah needs them. My Miles needs them. We all need it. We all need to be the keepers and the carriers of the cultural legacy that is us.
Well, Amber, we know that you are going to be around for a very long time. And I speak for both Tressie and I when I say we are very excited to see what you do next. You are a bright, bright, truly, shining star and a force in this world. And we thank you for everything
thank
you
y'all
do.
For having
you a
me.
Starra, girl. You a starra. Thank you, Amber. Thank you, Amber. Stay safe, stay well, stay joyful, girl. Thanks. I love it.
Thank y'all.
Yeah. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to all of you who've been emailing us and tweeting about Here to Slay. We really do love hearing from you. Roxanne and I are constantly shooting your messages back and forth to each other. A special thanks to Jamila this week, who told us that her husband is more aware of the staffing in his office because she makes him listen to Here to Slay in the car. And as a result of being more aware, he is paying more attention to hiring Black women because she said to him, "You gotta listen to Here to Slay." If you don't already, force the man in your life to listen, okay? What's the worst that can happen? Meanwhile, follow us and tell us what you think of the show on Twitter and Instagram at HEAR2SLAY.
From Luminary, Here to Slay is executive produced by us, Roxanne Gay and Tressie McMillan-Cottom. Our senior producer is Curtis Fox, and our producer is Catherine Fenelosa. Production support from Lauren Garcia and Caitlin Adams, and our wonderful interns are Allie McPherson and Isoke Samuel.
Right? I felt like we did.
When we're on, we're on.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.